Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, hello, everybody. The big news, by the way, is that in our new building, which we'll be moving into in a few months, air-conditioned main auditorium. So, well, listen, welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, June 19th, 2017. Now, last week, I'm sure you've heard about this, President Trump held a rather unusual cabinet meeting. You did hear about it. Well, in the immortal words of NPR's Peter Sagal, the president began his first ever cabinet meeting by going around the table and having every single secretary effusively praise him. It was the single most obsequious, suck-uppy performance by a cabinet since the dishes in Beauty and the Beast sang, "Be our guest," unquote. Well, I'm John Zipperer. I wish I had written that line, but I'm your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we are, in fact, going to talk about the latest with President Trump and his legal troubles, let's say. Also, Georgia's special election this week, some interesting bills in Sacramento, last week's mass shootings, and, of course, other political news, and we'll round out the evening with our live news quiz. As always, I note that the Commonwealth Club is a place for people with a wide range of views, so any opinions that are expressed here tonight are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for tonight. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage. We welcome back Carson Bruno. He's the Assistant Dean for Admission and Program Relations at Pepperdine University's School of Public Policy. He's also the author of the California Real Politic newspaper. You can find him on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. So welcome back, Carson.
Thank you.
Our next panelist is no stranger to the Commonwealth Club, but he's joining our week-to-week panel for the first time. He's Dan Schnur, the director for the Los Angeles region of the American Jewish Committee. He's also the former chairman of California's Fair Political Practices Commission, and he's on Twitter at Dan Schnur. So welcome to the panel, Dan. And next to me is Barbara Marshman. She's the editorial pages editor for the Mercury News, and you can find her on Twitter at Barb Marshman, so welcome.
And let me just say, these gentlemen obviously didn't get the memo, but I'd just like to say, John, that you are the best panel host I have ever encountered.
Oh, here, here. Yeah.
Go on. We've got an hour. Listen, I think you know how we do this. There are question cards spread throughout the room, so write them out, and we'll pick them up, and I'll try to ask as many as I can during this hour. Now, by the way, we are being live streamed, so some folks are watching us on YouTube. So, hello, internet world. So now, we know that President Trump is a focus of Robert Mueller's investigation, don't we? Or is he? So yesterday, his lawyer, Jay Sekulow, said the president is not under investigation. Now, that's the only the tip of the iceberg, I guess, for the legal problems that are going on. Barbara, from what we know so far, is the president under investigation? Does it matter? Is this semantics? I mean,
I can't imagine that he is not somehow pulled into this, whether it's, I mean, I guess it would be obstruction of justice. I mean, he knew Michael Flynn was taking money from a foreign power. He didn't want to fire Michael Flynn. There are just so many bizarre twists and turns. And, you know, my sense is if Mueller was given a wide open palette, I don't see how he could not investigate the president. I don't know if there's anything there, but I don't see how he could not look at it.
Dan, what do you think when you're watching what's going on and then the fighting over even just whether or not he's being investigated? Is this how serious? If you were in advising the president, what kind of advice
would you
give?
That's quite a lead into a sentence.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I'm going to start off by recommending a book to you. Mark Fisher and Michael Cranish of the Washington Post wrote a terrific book. It's not a terrific book, an instructive book last year called Trump Revealed. And with no fewer than 32 of their Washington Post colleagues, did really an extraordinary and an impressive deep dig into Mr. Trump's entire life leading up to his campaign for president. And there's any number of things that, you know, strike the reader, the one of which I'll offer here, is not just the fact that he demands, if not craves, public and media attention, but the nature of it. The former basketball player Dennis Rodman once said, "The only bad press is an obituary." And Trump, President Trump, if you read Trump Revealed, and if you read Art of the Deal, you will see that, joking aside, he believes that. He believes, and I'm not saying this in a positive or negative way, just observing, he came to believe over his years of experience in the cauldron that is the New York City media market, that it is better, it is preferable to receive unfavorable attention than no attention at all.
Because at least they're talking about you.
Yeah, and if you look, and it's because it's easier once they're paying attention to you to change the nature of the conversation to something that might work to your benefit than to try to get noticed if they're ignoring you. That's something a skill that he employed to great effect throughout his previous careers. Mm-hmm. If you look back at the primary and the general election campaign, he used that approach to great skill. And now for the first time, he's running up against not political, not media obstacles, but legal obstacles. And you can tell that that is a new experience for him, and he's still struggling to figure out how to deal with it.
Yeah,
Carson, your thoughts?
Yeah, for someone who has built his entire career, his entire adulthood, over a consistent message that is building the Trump image, which is, he's a fantastic marketer, a fantastic public relations person. Businessman, you can quibble about, but he is a fantastic at marketing, and he's built this Trump image throughout his entire career, and it's been consistent. You know exactly what you're getting when you see a Trump stamp on any of the products. Gaudy, over the top, ostentatious, but you know what you're going to get. With the marketing, the public affairs, public relations coming out of the White House, you have no clue what you're going to get. Sean Spicer says one thing, and then Huckabee says something completely different, not only a few minutes later, and then Trump that evening tweets something out completely different. And so from a consistency standpoint, the message is all over the place, which I just can't, it doesn't jive with kind of the marketing approach that Trump has really taken through his entire career, which could speak to either just pure chaos in the White House, that no one really knows what's happening, which is kind of scary, or it could be that they're trying this kind of smoke and mirrors approach where just trying to throw everything out as much as possible, see what sticks, see what CNN starts talking about, see what Fox News starts defending, and kind of go from there. But either approach really isn't, it's not going to be very successful at the end if Mueller is actually investigating him and if there's actually something there that sticks from a legal perspective. Yeah. The best tweet can't save you in the courtroom, unfortunately.
So we have seen that the Senate testimonies, both of former FBI Director James Comey, excuse me, and U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Start with you, Barbara, again. Who was more effective in those testimonies, do you think?
I may be prejudiced here, but I just found Jeff Sessions amazingly clueless on so many things. I mean, he just did not seem to have a grasp of what was going on. Comey is a huge ego, and I would not say he's 100% credible, but he said some self-damaging things. I mean, he admitted to leaking the memos, which is kind of a weird thing. But it made me feel like he's probably telling the truth about most of it, because if you're going to cover things up, why wouldn't you cover up the kind of screwy thing that you did?
There were some analyses after that, after James Comey's testimony, saying that he had left certain breadcrumbs for Mueller to follow in his mm-hmm. testimony. What do you think of that? I mean,
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Comey, unlike Sessions, unlike Trump, unlike most of the members of both committees, is a legal is a law enforcement official. And he understands very clearly how these investigations are done. He knows what he's able to communicate and not able to communicate to a special investigator. And so I think even some of the short-term, either self-deprecating or potentially damaging things that he said at his own expense were done very, very deliberately to paint a roadmap for Mueller to follow going forward. For Sessions, he just, in my mind, and again, this is not criticism, he just seemed startled. After 20 years in the United States Senate, he had come to a, he had come, as most senators do, to expect a certain level of collegiality and mutual respect from other senators. They always say, my dear friend from the state of Massachusetts, so-and-so. That's the way they talk to each other. And you could tell that he hadn't prepared for a more confrontational, more direct type of questioning. Now, it does not feel me, and I'm not, I suspect many of you feel responded the same way. It does not fill me with confidence when the nation's top law enforcement admits that he is frightened by difficult questions. I think he came across poorly, not because of the substance of his answers, but because of his lack of preparation. And I think by comparison, suffered greatly as opposed to Comey.
Do you agree, or do you think maybe Jeff Sessions was handicapped a bit by that dynamic you were talking about earlier of, I can come out here and say something, and 2 hours later, my boss might tweet that, I explained this all to Jeff Sessions over dinner.
I mean, there definitely is that element to it, which I think it's, I think working for Trump has to be the hardest job, no matter what role you're in, cabinet. I mean, Sean Spicer, we've seen, obviously, he's struggling a little bit at it. But I think that element kind of plays into kind of the nature of kind of, I don't know what I can say because I don't know what my boss is going to turn around and say 20 minutes later. But I also think that largely, if you've ever been to a committee hearing of any level, Sacramento, in D.C., a high-profile one, something on the most boring topic ever, it's all theatrics. It's all about theatrics. And so, yeah, these public hearings are important, and they're necessary, but the real substance isn't going to happen in those meetings. Everything is, if it's done right, all the questions have been pre-prepared and thoroughly vetted. All the statements have been pre-prepared and thoroughly vetted. You kind of essentially know where the direction of the conversation is going to go. And so it's going to be really kind of behind the scenes and kind of seeing kind of what unfolds between leaks and between then kind of what Mueller and his staff, staff attorneys will actually end up publishing and putting out at the end of the day.
And what happens in those
private meetings?
Private meetings, that Comey kept talking about. I can explain the good stuff for you in that. It's like a pay-per-view meeting you have to hold later.
Right. So there's going to be a lot more questions being asked, I think, for a long, long time before any sort of actual resolutions are going to be made on any of these kind of allegations.
Now, sticking with you, Carson, and working backwards on the panel, what did you think of the performance of California's two senators, Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein? Both were major parts of it, but also were quite different in their approaches.
Harris definitely used it to raise her profile as much as she possibly could within D.C. and in a short amount of time. And I'm not too surprised by that. She's known for being a very cautious politician as on a whole, but she is a trained prosecutor.
That came across, definitely.
And so a committee hearing of that nature is the type of setting that she's going to really shine because that is where she's comfortable. She knows how to ask a tough question and try to get the response that she's trying to get from someone who's on the stand, and whether that's sitting in the committee, the committee chair, or whatever it may be. So I'm not unsurprised by her performance. But I you know, in a way, I'm kind of glad to see her actually start to do something. And trust me, I'm not the Kamala Harris fan here. But it's finally nice to see her kind of step out of this kind of cocooned, cautious shell that she has really kind of put on since she first became Attorney General back in 2010.
You know, John, though, in fairness to Senator Harris, since arriving in Washington, and you're right, her trademark throughout her career has been one of real caution. But she also understands that having been elected to this seat, She can now hold it for the rest of her life if she so chooses.
Yeah.
And so she has been somewhat less cautious since getting there, and been very aggressive, primarily in issues relating to immigration and climate change and others. The challenge, of course, is you have, out of 535 members of Congress, roughly 533 being very aggressive on something or other. And so it tends to get lost in the cacophony. Because this is such a unique forum, like Adam Schiff on the House side, she has very, very wisely used this very high-profile opportunity to her advantage. I don't think, and I don't pretend to know, but I can't imagine that Senator Harris is going to run for president in 2020. But I know that she is smart enough to understand that she benefits in all sorts of ways politically from the speculation relating to the race. Yeah. And for those of you who are of my generation, you remember the tremendous fun that New York Governor Mario Cuomo had for decades, centuries, generations, speculating about whether he would run for president or not. And aside from the fact that he was genuinely undecided, he realized very quickly that it elevated his stature in his home state to be talked about in that context. And if you are Kamala Harris, all of a sudden you're not one of 100 senators. You're one of a much smaller number of people being talked about in much more rarefied ways, and that can help on any number of fronts. And there's no question that she used that to her benefit this past week. You're exactly right, Carson.
Barbara?
Well, I share Carson's reservations about Kamala because I was optimistic about her as Attorney General, and she really did nothing. I mean, she stopped short of real accomplishments in almost everything she tried out of an abundance of caution. She's definitely running for president. I would hope not 2020, but it's definitely the goal. And I guess she did a good. I mean, she certainly drew attention to herself in the questioning. I actually thought, as a prosecutor, if she had been before a jury with some of those witnesses, she might have annoyed them by her persistence. It was very very intense, and I can say that because I'm a woman. I found it perhaps a little excessive, but maybe it's just because I'm used to her not being that forceful on things.
John, can I interject on this
for
one moment? I believe, because she's very smart, that was entirely intentional upon her.
Yeah, it probably was.
Because you weren't her audience. The witnesses weren't the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Her audience was the base of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The people who are most frustrated by Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and other Democrats who they do not believe are fighting the good fight the way they believe it should be fought. What she was doing in that hearing was saying, don't think about Bernie Sanders. Don't think about Elizabeth Warren. Think about me, because I am your champion, and I will irritate and offend people who you would like to see irritated and offended. Very quickly before we move on, I think it is worth noting and taking a note, because you asked about Senator Feinstein.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And of course, one of the great parlor games, not just in San Francisco, but throughout the galaxy, is whether Dianne Feinstein will run for re-election in 2018. I'd be interested in what you guys think, but I became absolutely convinced that Dianne Feinstein was going to seek another term in office, not when she began hosting fundraisers, which she did several months ago, but rather when she was questioning James Comey in the hearing, because she had a look on her face which said, this is important. This needs to be done in a way that the partisan voices on both sides will not do it, and I'm having fun.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But here's a question on Kamala's approach and Adam Schiff, who is also a prosecutor and has a very different method of coming at things. He's very careful and kind of works people into that corner where he wants them in a much more studied way. People tell me he has no charisma and he has no political future. I'm curious what you all think.
Well, I think he's blessed in a way. I guess blessed might not be the right word, but he's blessed that he has a chairmanship to basically use as his platform. So he can be a lot more deliberate in kind of how he approaches these things, because he knows that he can always get onto any television show he wants, just being the chairman of the committee that he's the chairman of, which Harris doesn't have that luxury, really, at this point in her career in D.C., so she needs to use any opportunity she possibly can to get onto those Sunday shows. I think he's definitely positioning himself that if Feinstein does retire, to try to essentially coalesce at least the congressional delegation around him to ensure or hopefully kind of block and tackle some of his other House members out of stepping into that race. Mm-hmm. So he only has to focus on kind of the Sacramento elected officials. But right. Who knows if that will work or not?
But I think that demeanor that you talk about is working to his advantage. I mean, I've known Adam Schiff since he first got to California as a state assembly member. Yeah, in the 1990s. In professional sports, they say that nice guys finish last. In politics, nice guys never get on cable television.
Yeah.
And he is a very nice, smart, very well-mannered, low-key person who has never gotten, frankly, the attention that's due to him because of his demeanor. But I would argue this. Given the stakes involved here, the fact that he is conducting himself in such a low-key, more methodical, measured manner, I think that works to his benefit. And a more conventional politician talking in sound bites might not be taken quite as seriously, where you know sometimes saying and ah in that sort of situation goes a long way because it reminds people that you're not just about putting points on the scoreboard. It demonstrates a different level of engagement.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Senator Harris for a moment, of course, she was rather famously cut off and told to not badger the witness, if you will. Someone in the audience asks, ought not the word misogyny be included in the discussion? What do you make of the brouhaha? Because, of course, she's also kind of made some hay out of it.
She definitely persisted. I do think, it is such a male bastion overall. And there is just no sensitivity on the part of those folks to how they will appear, and definitely looked patronizing to me.
I have a close friend by the name of Wendy Gruhl, who ran for mayor of Los Angeles about 5 years ago. Very impressive woman, very impressive public servant. And she came and talked to my class at USC not too long ago and got onto this very point.
Yeah.
And she says, if Dan says something, he's tough.
Yeah.
If I say it, excuse my language, I'm a bitch. But what was really interesting, it was really important, and I think Kamala Harris gets this also, is Wendy then went on to say, she said, at that point, she said, I have two choices. I can complain and say, it's not fair, there's a double standard. Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, I can put my head down and work twice as hard as Dan does and get done what I need to anyway. And I think for the young women in my class, rather than either denying the double standard or simply complaining about it, the message that she sent, I think, is a very valuable one. And I will note that Senator Ronald Wyden was just as strident as Senator Harris was. And if you know, whether that's gender or racial and ethnic demographic characteristics or a combination of both, it was very noticeable how both the reaction from her colleagues and from the media was, no question.
I mean, didn't Wyden directly accuse Sessions of obstructing the work of the committee?
Yes, but he was wearing pants.
Carson, Mueller's investigation, of course, apparently is reaching into Trump's inner circle.
Yeah.
Jared Kushner is reportedly another object of investigation. What do you think the effects of that is? Or including kind of how that affects the White House itself.
Yeah. Beyond. Well, when I saw that Vice President Pence has hired attorneys, I was thinking, oh, well, this has actually just been a massive plot by Paul Ryan to become President of the United States and never having to run a presidential campaign ever again.
It's a house of cards.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all coming together now, and it all makes sense, finally, because I've been trying to make sense out of it since 2015. But in all seriousness, it's got to be debilitating. Now, granted, I've never been in the Oval Office. Yeah. I've never held any sort of positions of that nature. But to have this kind of cloud kind of coming in, you know, over the White House lawn and kind of just hovering there, has to be debilitating to low-level staffers all the way up, because you never know kind of who's going to be called in to be questioned, kind of who's going to be, you know, thrown out the door next. If someone like Jared Kushner is under investigation, who's so close to, you know, related to the president and the first daughter, then, you know, things got to be pretty sticky situation in there. So it's got to be really tough. And you brought up kind of how this is kind of go into the agenda then.
Yeah.
Grant, let's remember, he got elected president making a bunch of promises. How is he actually doing at those? And it's obvious that it's really kind of hit the brakes on kind of how D.C. is functioning, both in Congress and in the White House. You know, the congressmen and senators are only being kind of, being inundated with questions about this, which then takes away from kind of doing the other work that they're elected to do. The White House, if you're constantly being inundated with questions about this, then you can't be kind of building a strategy about how to get your policy promises, policy prescriptions through Congress and onto his desk. So,
Dan, your thoughts on that?
I don't remember who it was, but one of the Clinton administration senior staffers was talking about this last week. And she said, it is paralyzing. She said, you spend every day looking at people and talking to people who you know are taking notes and talking to their lawyers about what they're talking to you about. And it doesn't matter how much you try to compartmentalize. It's simply impossible to put that out of your mind and try to concentrate on your work at hand, because you know not only anything you say or do today could end up in front of a grand jury, but anything that you've said or done over the last several years could as well. And you find yourself not only self-editing but self-questioning, which, as you pointed out correctly, is not an ideal way to get your job done. But I think your other point is exactly the right one, too. The other real impact here, is on public policy. And if you happen to have voted for Donald Trump because of his policy agenda, and I'm guessing that's a relatively limited subset of the of the room here, you are frustrated that it's not getting done. But if you are a member of Congress, even who agrees with the White House on policy issues, you don't have the level of trust in them necessary to take political risks on your own behalf. And that's not just the scandal. That's just the way Trump works, as we were talking about earlier. If you remember the U.S. House of Representatives, the Republican caucus, and you voted for a health care bill that is now one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation in American political history, and you stood at the White House with the president who praised you for voting it, the most important word from a political, not a legal or constitutional standpoint, the most important word uttered in Washington last week was the word mean. Mm-hmm. It was when Donald Trump called the House bill that passed mean. The Democratic Congressional Committee was within nanoseconds making a television commercial out of Trump's words to run against every single Republican House member who voted for that bill in a competitive district next year. And that's a problem on health care. But when the White House needs that same member's vote on infrastructure or on taxes or on anything else, the member's party loyalty is going to be a lot less significant than it might be under more normal circumstances.
Sure. Barb, so do you think many House Republicans will be seeking Donald Trump to come and campaign for them in 2018?
I don't think so. Going back to the Jared and Ivanka issue, the nepotism of that, I mean, people overseas are just astonished that America does this. I mean, imagine if Hillary Clinton had brought Chelsea and her husband into the White House next to her. You would people would have gone crazy. And both of them are clearly in their own business, making their own money, and we're really not seeing public benefit out of either of them. Jared never talks, and, you know. I love the speculation about what his voice might actually sound like.
He talked today.
Did he?
Yeah.
I missed that. Mm-hmm. What's he sound like?
Email.
John, just real quick, on the question of congressional candidates asking for support, though, Barbara and I might disagree a little bit on this. For those of you who are watching, there was a primary for Governor Virginia in that state last week. And the establishment candidate, who had endorsed Trump, but not very enthusiastically, a gentleman by the name of Ed Gillespie, outspent his Trumpish grassroots activist opponent by roughly a 4-to-5, 1-to-1 margin. Mm-hmm. And Gillespie won that primary by barely 1 percentage point, which means that there is still a very sizable cohort of Trump supporters out there, particularly in Republican Party primaries. He may have a more limited travel schedule in terms of geographic spread.
Yeah.
But I think in the midterm elections, he'll be very much in demand.
Probably in primaries, I think that's I think that's true.
Okay.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Before we move on from Trump's legal issues, someone in the audience asks, can we expect anything from Mueller, in other words, anything to come out of the Mueller stuff, or do we have to wait until any, you know, it's either an announcement about charges or no charges? Is this going to be a lot of just tea reading and criminology until he actually comes out, or are there steps, you know, do we learn who he's calling in for investigate or testimony or whatever he does, torture?
I don't think we learn anything officially. I mean, I'm sure there will be leaks, but if he's smart, I think he will hold it all just the way a district attorney would hold a...
Well, and certainly all the descriptions of him are that he's very smart.
That he's smart, yes. Yes. So I would say no, there's not going to be an announcement out of him.
It's worth remembering that there was almost a 2-year span between the break into the Democratic headquarters at the Watergate Hotel and President Nixon's resignation. I saw a pundit on the morning of the Comey testimony saying this is the Super Bowl of something. And I'd say it's not the Super Bowl. It wasn't the first round of a 15-round prize fight. It might have been the first 100 yards of a 26-mile marathon. But I suspect that this is going to be going on for quite some time.
It's going to go on for a long time. Also because so much of what kind of needs to be investigated has transpired for quite some time already. I mean, you're talking about going back to mid-2015, if not earlier, and that needs, so there's a lot of kind of digging that needs to happen just before even he became the nominee, let alone then kind of the entire then presidential campaign itself, and then obviously his time in office. So it's going to take some time, and Mueller is, he's tough. I mean, if something were going down, I would be really concerned about what my future holds for me if I was, you know, potentially even on the, you know, periphery of kind of what the investigation could be. So, unfortunately, it's going to be a lot of speculation. The CNN's going to be, having a payday out of this. But from when it comes to real facts and hard, cold kind of what is actually happening, unfortunately, we probably won't know 100% for quite some time.
Okay. And remember that the precipitating factor really with Nixon was the tapes. And while we don't know for sure there are no tapes in this case,
which is unfortunate for going into 2018 for Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, because this is just going to be hanging over their heads as they try to hold on to their majorities going into the midterm elections, which we know are historically bad for the party that holds the White House. So the headwinds are already against them. You have a president that's really unpopular when it comes to approval ratings, and then something like this. It's just, it's not a position where NCCC and the NRSC really want to be right now.
Well, speaking of other elections, there is actually some political news besides Donald Trump's legal issues, and that is tomorrow there is a special election in Georgia. It's an Atlanta suburban district once held by Newt Gingrich. the Democrats seem to think, and polls show, they've got a chance of stealing that, of flipping that district tomorrow. It is a very expensive race. We were talking about this before. I mean, this is like Senate level or governor race level stuff. Carson, why is this race so slow? Is the district changing demographically, or is it Trump or something else?
Well, yeah, it's some history. So it was Newt Gingrich's seat. It was Tom Price's seat, and Tom Price is now the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which is why the special election is occurring. Mitt Romney won the seat by 20-plus points. Tom Price, when he ran for re-election in 2016, won the seat by 20-plus points. So it's a historically red district, north the suburbs north of Atlanta. However, Trump only just squeaked by and won the district in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. Why? It's because it is one of the most well-educated districts in the country. In fact, New York Times did a great kind of infographic today that showed the top 15 most educated districts in the country and who represents them right now. This Georgia 6 and Virginia 10, which is suburbs of D.C., are the only two Republican-held districts of that top 15. And so it goes to show you kind of just is this a kind of reorientation of politics where not only kind of looking at kind of the white versus minority kind of percentage in a district, but also the percentage of people with bachelor degrees, is that a leading indicator of kind of where that district is partisan is going to vote when it comes to elections? I don't know. I think it's still too early to really kind of say that. Special elections are always kind of tough to kind of read the tea leaves and kind of figure out what this means for the future. But it's definitely worth noting that the Democrats have a chance at actually winning this. And the Republicans are having to spend so much money in order to hold a district where Mitt Romney and Tom Price just a few years ago would have never blinked an eye to be worried about losing this district, this seat.
Dan, what would it mean for the Democrats if they don't win this? I mean, they couldn't flip that seat in Kansas, which they weren't expected to. Yeah. But you know, when your energy is really going up and you've got millions of people marching, you kind of think you can do things. If they don't win tomorrow, do you think this could take the wind out of their sails, or that they'll say, okay, hey, look, we got close in a place that we have lost by 20 points or more?
At a certain point, you have to win. And if the Republican candidate, Ms. Handel, is elected tomorrow, that's a significant psychological blow for the Democrats because expectations have been so high. Most Democrats really didn't get that upset when the Kansas and the Montana races went the other way because those districts were never expected to be seriously contested. This one is. That said, it would be a psychological blow, but probably not much else. Because by the time districts like this boat around the country, economically upscale communities that have historically voted Republican, by the time they vote next November, so much new history will have happened. Yeah. It's hard to see this having a great impact. Just to back up for 1 second on this, John, I think it's worth noting why a district like this changes. A well-educated, a well-off, an economically comfortable suburban community. Mm-hmm. These are classic old-style Republicans. Mm-hmm. And the reason the district was so close last November is not because the Democratic base was tremendously energized, not because lots of swing voters voted for Clinton rather than for the Republican they were used to, but because traditional Republicans, economically conservative, maybe not socially moderate, but socially closer to moderate Republicans who voted for Mitt Romney and John McCain just simply weren't comfortable with Donald Trump. For decades, for most of modern American history, the single most reliable indicator on whether someone will vote for a Republican or a Democrat was their income level. The more money you made, the more likely you were to vote Republican. The more less money you made, the more likely you were to vote Democrat. In the early stages of the previous decade, the first decade of the 21st century, that changed. The single most reliable demographic indicator in America today on whether you'll vote Republican or Democrat is no longer income, is the frequency with which you attend religious services. And so economically successful, socially moderate voters who voted Republican for many, many years, you may remember the term soccer mom from the 1990s began shifting in one direction, and economically populist, socially conservative voters, you may remember the term NASCAR dad from the following decade, began shifting in the other. In a district like this one, which has been a suburban, traditionally upscale Republican district, is still Republican, but it's Mitt Romney, George Bush Republican, yeah, not Donald Trump
right.
Republican.
Right. What are you expecting tomorrow out of Georgia?
I would like to see the Democrat win. He's an interesting young man, but
he looks like he's like 14.
He does, yes, very young. And thank you. I never know, and I can't tell ages anymore. But I have a bad feeling about it. I think the Republican will win. She's not a terrible candidate. She's a good candidate. I think the Democrats' best chance was to eke it out in the primary when there were many different Republicans running.
The momentum is definitely behind Karen Handel, the Republican. Mm-hmm. You saw the recent polls have really kind of gone yeah. from a decent John Ossoff margin, mm-hmm. you know, looking at 3 to 5 points maybe, to now basically a coin toss 50-50, yeah. With especially polls that just came out earlier today. So it's what one of those races where it's going to be literally kind of the turnout. Can you get your yeah. people to turn out and actually vote? And in a high intensity, high stakes game like this, it is a little bit easier to do so, but it's all going to be margins. I mean, it's going to be precinct by precinct looking at kind of seeing what's happening on the ground. So it's going to be exciting. And for us, it'll be exciting to watch because we have the time change working in our favor. So, but yeah, it's going to be close, and it's going to be an important race for both parties.
But an important race psychologically.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Again, it's just one person out of 500 or in the House, 430 plus.
Sure.
So.
Well, then let's talk about something closer to home, and that is California, literally home. Now, California, like many big cities within it, and well, as well as other cities across the country, has placed itself squarely in opposition to the Trump administration's immigration policies, including its aggressive deportation activity. The state legislature recently passed a bill including millions of dollars to defend immigrants from deportation. There was already money being spent on groups working with immigrants to, for example, work them through the immigration system. They added some more money, and I guess it's specifically to help them mm-hmm. fight being deported. Mm-hmm. Dan, is this taxpayer money well spent?
So I tell my kids that 50 is the new 30. My wife tells me that orange is the new black. In Donald Trump's America, I would submit to you that California is the new Texas. This is the way federalism is supposed to work. 8 years ago, when a new president was elected, the people of Texas and their elected representatives who had voted for their opponent were outraged. And they worked very, very hard in any number of ways to do everything they could mm-hmm. to keep Barack Obama's agenda from being implemented in their red state of Texas. Mm-hmm. And 8 years later, the White House went in the other direction. And not surprisingly, the state of California, which is just as blue as Texas is red, is responding in exactly the same way. When we talk about separation of powers, we tend to think about the three branches of government. But it's worth remembering that those checks and balances work vertically mm-hmm. and not just horizontally. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Brown and Javier Becerra and Ed Lee and Kevin DeLeon and any number of other local and state elected officials are not only doing what they're allowed to do under the Constitution, they're doing what they're supposed to do under the Constitution, just as Greg Abbott and Rick Perry and a lot of very deeply committed conservatives did in Texas in 2009.
Barbara, would a cynic be correct in saying Democrats also have a particular interest in this because they expect those immigrants, once naturalized, to become Democratic voters?
Yes, on one craven level, yes, I think. They
craven in politics?
Them,
what?
Most of them probably would be. But the people who will be defended or helped now, I think, are a long way from voting citizenship. I'm not crazy about spending taxpayer money defending, but I do see in our community in San Jose some real injustices happening. I mean, people who have been reporting to ICE regularly as required and working on legalization and they're out of here. And it's frightening to their wives and children or husbands and children. Children are usually citizens, often the spouses, and it's very disruptive to the communities. San Jose, since I got there in the late 80s, has always resisted or refused to work with ICE on raids or any of those things. It was not ICE at the time. The INS, I guess. Because the communities are so, you do have people who are here who did not cross the border legally, mingled with large families, I mean, who may be largely citizens or here legally, and to keep community trust, you just can't have the local police looking predatory. And actually, there are a fair number of communities in Texas that have done that for a long time. Any police department that values community trust, you just can't do that in an area where there are immigrants. So I have sympathy with a lot of it, and I'm glad California is trying to be a supportive environment, but I'm not sure a lot of money should be spent on lawyers for folks. I think there are bigger picture ways to deal with the situation.
I would agree both with what Barbara and Dan just said, and add this. I mean, it's when you look at kind of what every state has a certain, you know, restricted resources. We can't spend everything we want to spend everything on because we just don't have the money to do so. So budgets are all about priorities, and this is obviously a very important priority for the Latino caucus in Sacramento, and they were very pleased and proud of themselves for getting the additional funding into the budget this past week. But is it the most effective way to help these people who are seriously struggling in their communities? Yes, there is this constant fear of ICE now, particularly with kind of the rhetoric that's coming out of Washington, D.C., but there's also the fear of, do I have enough money for food? Do I have enough money for gas? Do I have enough money for pay my bills? Can I actually live within a two-hour commute radius of where I work? And so there are many, many, many ways that Sacramento can be really trying to tackle many of these fundamental challenges that not just illegal and legal immigrants are facing in California, but many other low-income to middle-class individuals throughout the state. And that's the important thing.
And on that, you know, real quick, going back to the point that Barbara was making a moment ago, if you are a Democratic politician in California, you know, beating up on Donald Trump is very cathartic. there's no political consequence. In fact, just the opposite. The more strident and the more combative you are, the more political reward there is. The danger, and both Carson and Barbara touched on this briefly, is the state of California has very pressing public policy needs. And while I would take a backseat to no one in standing up for the otherwise law-abiding undocumented residents of California among us, I also wouldn't mind if they devoted a little bit of time and attention to addressing the affordable housing issue before, in between their anti-Trump news conferences.
Yeah, the UCLA economist came out today or yesterday, relatively recently, with a great quote. He said, "You know, President Trump is trying to build a wall, along our southern border. California politicians are building a wall along the border of California, and it's because of the housing affordability issue. If people can't afford to live here, then you're not going to have anyone living here. So we're essentially, through our policies, already forcing people out or preventing people from coming in." And that's a real scary situation for our economy, for our budget, and then for all of these other policy issues that we do care deeply about.
Speaking of some other policy issues,
yes.
Carson, you've been talking about budget trailers of note recently. First of all, explain what budget trailers are, yeah. and then tell us what concerns you right now.
Well, I'm sure Dan has had lots of experience with the budget trailer process in Sacramento. But budget trailer bills are the bills that are, in a sense, meant to implement the pieces that are passed in the budget. So it's the actions necessary to implement the spending that the budget is authorizing. Very important situation, as long as they are used to actually implement pieces that are associated with the budget. What has really become a nifty little trick that used in Sacramento, and I would probably gather that if Republicans ruled Sacramento, they would do the exact same thing, unfortunately. But people right now, Jerry Brown and the legislative leaders, Kevin DeLeon and Anthony Rendon, will... amongst themselves, kind of get together, figure out what policy issues that they want to get implemented immediately, because a budget trailer bill goes into effect on July 1st. You don't have to wait typically to January 1st of the next year for this to go into effect. They will insert these policy items that are parts of their kind of their legislative agenda into the budget, in a sense, kind of create poison pills to make sure that no one votes against them. They become immediately, all you need is a majority, simple majority to pass them, and then they become immediately passed and immediately implemented only a few weeks later. And this year, they've done some major things, one of which was a complete rehaul of how we do recall elections in the state of California, which conveniently there is a Democratic state senator in Southern California who's trying to be recalled right now by some conservative activists over his vote for the gas tax increase, which will now essentially delay the process until November 2018, so this recall election will be held on the same day as the regularly scheduled midterm elections. A blatant effort to basically save one of their own by Kevin DeLeon. Every newspaper has called them out on it, and it's really kind of, in a way, bastardized the recall process.
Yeah.
The second one is a major rehaul of the Board of Equalization, which how many people have actually heard of the Board of Equalization?
I need to stop asking those sort of questions
because you guys are some of the most educated people out there.
Yeah.
So you're so smart, you could live in Atlanta's.
That's right.
Exactly. Well, so Carson, I lived in San Francisco for 7 years. What I learned is you never ask a rhetorical question at the Commonwealth Club.
Right. Yeah. I fell into that trap.
So now, this is they not only want to make changes to the Board of Equalization, they've got a very short time limit. What's this about?
So this is essentially gutting the Board of Equalization. The Board of Equalization has become a massive tax collection and tax judiciary in a way of handling basically all sales taxes, all property taxes, essentially everything that's not connected to the income tax, which is handled by the Franchise Tax Board. Their four members are elected, but four districts throughout the entire state. The state controller is the fifth voting member and typically the chair. Although sometimes I guess that does rotate. And they've had some struggles recently with borderline public corruption, misuse of spending, buying lavish furniture for their office, mistreating employees, using public employees for political purposes. The list goes on. The state auditor had issued a pretty scathing report by what's happening in the Board of Equalization. So what this trailer essentially did was gutted all their responsibilities down to the core. It is a constitutional office, so they couldn't completely eliminate it without going to the voters to amend the Constitution. But they gutted it down to its most basics and divvied out the responsibilities to two new organizations, two new bureaucracies in Sacramento.
Two new substantial bureaucracies.
Yeah, so now we will have four tax-related agencies in Sacramento handling all of our taxes, which is California was one of very few states that had two major organizations managing taxes within the state. Now we've doubled that, and we're at four now.
Dan?
If you think it's helpful, John, and if the answer is no, I promise my feelings won't be hurt. It's worth a minute to pick up where Carson left off and explain what a trailer bill is and why it is such an absurd undermining of the legislative process as it's supposed to work.
Please.
So, back in days of yore, a budget was passed as a piece of legislation. And then legislators, smart legislators of both parties, decided, wait a minute, because we have to pass a budget, we can put all sorts of other things in the budget that don't have anything to do with the budget that wouldn't be able to pass otherwise. Now, the problem with that is there is a single subject rule for legislation. I can't introduce a bill to increase the number of charter schools and ban fracking. I need to do that in two separate pieces of legislation. So they said, what we're going to do now when we pass the budget is the budget package will be a number of pieces of legislation on which the members will vote in via vote individually so as not to violate the single subject rule, but to make it tougher for either a governor to veto because it's part of the budget or for a legislator to oppose. So let me give you an example. Let's say that I decide I want to introduce a bill to proclaim Golden State Warriors Day in California. Okay, now how's that as a good use of taxpayer money? But all over California, there are Lakers and Clippers and Kings fans who are outraged at the thought that we would have Golden State Warriors Day in Sacramento. And so I know I can't get the bill passed because there's way too many Southern California and Central Valley legislators who will vote against it. So, I make it a trailer bill to the budget. And I also introduce a provision that says, and unless there is a Golden State Warriors Day in California, we will no longer give ice cream and puppies to orphans in California. And so therefore, if you vote against the bill for Golden State Warriors Day, I will run campaign commercials against you next year saying that you are against giving puppies and ice cream to orphans in California.
What a shame.
And as a result, and by the way, in order to include it as part of the budget, there has to be a budgetary impact. So I will print up enough flyers proclaiming Golden State Warriors Day that it will cost a dollar. And now there's an impact on the California state budget of $1, and therefore it needs to be included in the overall budget package. That's what a trailer bill is.
And they usually skirt the legislative process.
Yeah.
That goes before the budget committee, but no other committees get to review this before it lands on the floor to be voted on by the entire chamber of the legislature. So there's really it's a really easy way for you to slip in major policy topics with really no oversight, no kind of back and forth, no debate, and then it becomes effective immediately as a result.
Well, I wanted to get into one other topic before we head to the news quiz. At my neighborhood shopping center in San Francisco this past weekend, I saw a fence covered with signs, flowers, candles, balloons of people who were doing this in memory of our local UPS driver, who was one of three UPS drivers who was killed in a mass shooting in San Francisco last Thursday. This was the same day, of course, that the shooting in, it was at Alexandria, outside Washington, where five people were wounded, and the gunman was shot and killed as well. We've brought these kinds of things up a number of times on a week-to-week over the past 5 years, and, shooting up a bunch of grade school kids or a nightclub in Miami hasn't changed, policy at all, but I'll just put it out there. Do you think anything might change now that Congress people are on the receiving end?
Didn't change with Gabby Gifford.
That's true.
And there's something in common there. The man who shot her and killed her aide was political, and he was angry at her for some bizarre thing. It was not a party thing, but the man was deranged. He's mentally ill, and that's the case with the shooter in at the softball practice. People had tried to get him treatment to deal with him, and had failed to do that. And it's a very hard thing. I mean, for about 5 minutes, Congress was all kumbaya, and Trump was very nice, and then it's quickly deteriorated again. I don't think it changes anything.
Yeah,
it's difficult to fathom in a community, in a political environment like the one in which we reside. But the country is very deeply and bitterly divided on this issue. And what's going to change, John? It appears, most appalling, the most likely legislative change will be to enhance security for members of Congress.
Yeah. Yep.
And it is fair to point out that if Mr. Scalise had not been there, there would have been no police presence at all.
And that is because
the tragedy would have become just unfathomable. But it is notable that unlike when these tragedies have happened all too frequently in the past, there was virtually no outcry from the other side of the aisle. And that's not because Democratic members of Congress are not principled people with very strong feelings on these issues, not all of them, but the large majority of them, but because they understand the political realities on this landscape. Is that a loud public demonstration on behalf of gun control would not only fail to result in gun control legislation, but could put many of them who don't reside in safe districts at some political risk.
Yeah. Carson, any thoughts?
I have to agree with kind of what both Barbara and Dan have said about this issue. I will reiterate kind of what Barbara was bringing up with, the gun control topic is always the one that's kind of brought up, discussed, whether it's by the members of Congress themselves or their supporters or other people. That's the immediately what's talked about. But rarely, not every time, but rarely is the mental health issue really, really delved into, really discussed, really kind of talked about. Are there ways, whether it's at the federal level or even at the state level, that we can be doing a lot more to treating, identifying, and dealing with the mental health component that is a large part of many of these shootings? Not all, but many of them are connected to that issue. It's something that continuously kind of goes unnoticed by both local officials and state officials. They'll pay kind of the proverbial 2 cents to it, but then kind of move on to other issues that may be a little bit more topic worthy for their own districts, for their own purposes. But that's one that really needs to be discussed more often, I think. And we can use these sort of tragedies to really try to at least get everyone kind of listening about it and talking about it, because I do think there's some bipartisan action that can be done on that topic in particular, which can make an impact down the road, hopefully.
I remember right after the Gabby Giffords shooting, David Brooks, the conservative New York Times columnist, was at the Commonwealth Club and was speaking about that because his deep interest really is in psychology and such, and he was talking about really that what we knew about the mental problems that this shooter had been going through and experiencing and not getting treatment for, and that he could tell his mind was not working right, and I suspect we will be having this discussion again.
Yeah, fortunately.
You may recall that one of the first actions of this Congress after it was sworn in was to eliminate a rule that had made it more difficult for people who were very specifically diagnosed as being mentally ill, and that
it's
made it again.
It's been said that our system of democracy is not one of majority rule, but it's a system of minority rule with majority acquiescence. And what that means is that small numbers of people who care very deeply and very passionately about an issue, any issue, are often able to prevail over much larger numbers of people who don't feel nearly as invested in the issue. It's become part of political mythology that Al Gore, until this last year, was the last presidential nominee to devote a significant amount of time to talking about the issue of gun control. Bill Clinton believes that the Democrats lost the House of Representatives in 1994 as a result of Clinton signing the assault weapons ban. So when Hillary Clinton began talking about the issue much more forcefully now than it had been in many years, there was a thought that the politics of this country had changed. And maybe not individually, but the cumulative impact of all these tragedies had made gun control the same type of motivating issue as gun ownership on the other side of the aisle. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the voter turnout figures in last November's election, particularly in upper Midwestern states, that's clearly not the case.
Mm-hmm. On that note, let's move to our news quiz. For those of you who have never been here for our news quiz, of course, what we do is I ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand, and I'll call your name. Or I'll call you on you. You can shout it out. If you get it right, Colette will give you some chocolate. If you do get it, then maybe sit in your hand for the rest of the game and let someone else win. But first question. The Vatican is reportedly developing a new doctrine that calls for excommunicating Roman Catholics who are associated with what? Ma'am, your hand went right up. That's right, the Mafia. Excuse me.
It's like all of Italy.
So according to the coroner, sleep apnea and a combination of other factors contributed to the death of whom? Ma'am, your hand shot right up. Sorry?
Carrie Fisher,
that is correct. Who described the lawyers who were suing her husband as, quote, totally unethical last week? Did you see this very big court case, sir? Bill Cosby's wife, Camille, that's correct. Donald Trump finally spent a weekend in what location? Sir, your hand went right up. I saw that first. Camp David, that's correct. Okay, so it's time for our regular Angela Merkel quiz question. I always have to include at least one. After meeting with Pope Francis, the German chancellor said the Pope urged her to preserve what? Sir?
The environment.
Right, the Paris the Environment Accord. So there's a new version of Canada's beloved loonie. That's their $2 coin. It does something no other currency does. What is it, sir?
It glows in the dark.
You need that really far.
Okay. Who is Mark Peterson and why is he in the news? Anybody? Mark Peterson? Give you a hint. He's a Bay Area person.
Lacey Peterson.
Wanted to guess, sir, ma'am? Very good. That's correct. He is the Contra Costa County District Attorney who just resigned after he was after 13 felony charges were filed against him. Just the District Attorney.
Bruce County.
Yeah. A Massachusetts judge found Michelle Carter guilty of what? The lady in the corner way back there was first. Sorry? Not exactly. I'm going to have, ma'am?
Involuntary
manslaughter. You might have heard about this case. She was the woman who sent texts to her boyfriend who basically urging him to commit suicide, and then he did. Okay, I need some happier ones here. Here's one. A Mexican politician is embroiled in a controversy in which he has been accused of plagiarizing what? Did you see this story?
This is the happier one?
Yeah. He's been accused of plagiarizing something in some videos that he's made. Sir?
The thesis for his law.
No. Good guess, though.
Great guess.
Okay. He was accused of plagiarizing the Netflix series House of Cards. Okay. Just happy questions. That's all I'm going to do from now on.
Plagiarizing the BBC version.
Well, that's not happy. What am I? That's terrible. There's not a lot of happy news out there. Russia said its military could now target what over Syria? Sir?
American aircraft.
This was in response to U.S. aircraft shooting down a Syrian plane. We have one left?
Yep, one left.
Okay, one more.
Happy now. Happy.
I know. I'm going to have to make something up. Well, this is great news, really. New financial documents show who owes at least $315 million to lenders. Ma'am, you said it. Donald Trump, right. There's no happier news than that. San Francisco. Listen, we'll have more news quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to talk about next time when we're here on Monday, July 10th, right here in San Francisco. It'll also be a lot cooler, I promise. Thank you to our panel, Dan Schnur, Carson Bruno, and Barbara Marshman. Thanks to all of you for coming out tonight, and thanks everyone watching online, listening online. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks for coming.